Good morning again to all of you. This week we're going to look at the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, the time of the return of the captivity. And I've titled this Israel and the Superpowers, simply because the House of Israel has always found itself in a neighborhood of powerful peoples. When God is with them, they're the most powerful people on the face of the earth. But without God, they become weak, despised, tormented. And so this week, we will take a closer look at the state of the House of Israel during their return from the Babylonian captivity and what lessons there are for us. Israel today lives in a neighborhood of nations with characteristics that are actually very similar to the peoples and nations they lived among centuries ago. They have few friends and many enemies. Now, the Middle East here, to help us grasp the area of the Middle East, I've superimposed a map of part of the United States on this area of the world. The map here can help us understand the distances in the Middle East, but it's also corrected for latitude, so you get a general comparison of climate. And I say general because climate is affected by so many different elements, such as large bodies of water and prevailing winds and elevation, which are different in these two areas of the world. But at least we get some idea. Now, I placed Miami in at the mouth of the Indus River, which is today the border between Pakistan and India. As an example, we see a journey from the mouth of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers to Israel following the Fertile Crescent, which would be going this way here. We can see that a journey like that would be similar from a trip from Houston to Dallas and then back down to El Paso, or similar to the distance taking our leave from Kentucky Bible School, going to Chicago, and then ending up in Kansas City. When we look at the House of Israel today, in many ways, not much has changed, whether it be the bordering nations, terrorist groups, neighboring nations, or influential superpowers. Hostility finds Israel overtly or diplomatically. One difference, the nations around them right now are followers, for the most part, of Islam, as opposed to other idolatrous followings of the past. But none of these peoples today, as in the past, truly seek the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And actually, that includes Israel. We have, as we see here, Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon. We have these groups that are against Israel today, and we have these neighboring countries, and as we see at the bottom, the U.S., UN, EU, and Russia, these are other powers that are acting as superpowers anyway these days to try and influence things that are going on in the Middle East. In the past, these were the powers that Israel had to deal with: Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, the Medes and the Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans. And, of course, they weren't all in ascendance at the same time. They had their ebb and flow over periods of history. But these empires had their final boundaries as well in different areas from one another, but they all had one thing in common, and that is at their zenith, they all included some or all of what is known as the Mesopotamia or the Fertile Crescent. Now this week, we will focus on one of the powers that is in our image of Nebuchadnezzar's image here, which represents Babylon, Media Persia, Greece, Rome, and the countries that we have in our we have around us today. But the one that we'll be interested in particular is Media and Persia. When the 70-year captivity prophesied by Jeremiah concluded, Cyrus the Persian had captured Babylon, and he began a new era for the Israelites, those who were willing to participate. Now, this is a depiction of the empire of the Medo-Persians at its greatest extent. Bounded by the Indus River on the east, the Caspian Sea, the Caucasus, the Black Sea on the north. We have Thrace and Macedonia out to the northwest, Cyrene to the southwest, and Upper Egypt, the Red Sea, Arabia, and the Persian Gulf, the Arabian Sea on the south. It was a very large empire. Within the last year or so, I've attended classes on the subject of the return of the captivity and seen new published material on this era in Israel's history. And they're all good. They all have good things for us to consider. But some of the things I wanted answered were not addressed in those publications or those lectures that were given. So the matters I'm about to present are the things of interest to me, and you're stuck with it. If the questions you have aren't answered, then you have a means to start a conversation with a brother or sister while you're here. Otherwise, do your own homework and seek God's help in a prayerful manner. One of the things I wanted to know was how the Medes fit into this picture, since the only Mede that's mentioned is the one in Daniel, Darius the Mede. He is mentioned as having Ahasuerus as his father. Those are the only ones that are mentioned. And I wanted to know the timeline that showed where Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Haggai, Zechariah fit with respect to each other. And so to do this, we'll need to start a review of history before Babylon in the time of the Assyrian Empire. Now, I'm going to say something right off. Some of you already know this, but you know how hard it is to look forward into the future. It's almost as hard as that to look backward into ancient history. Because even though when you're going to school and you have a teacher that gives you your history lesson, they present it as, that's it. These are the dates, these are the things that happened, and that's it. But when you go look at the material, it's not so easy to figure it out. Somebody has made some calculations or decided on what they're going to present as what is true. I don't have all the answers for things here. I'm going to present what I think is right, but once again, I'm not going to be dogmatic about it, and it is history. It's not something that you have to have in your search for truth, but I just want you to understand that many times especially we as Bible students, we have a we look to the Bible as the basis of our truth, and we accept that. And that's the basis upon which we do most everything that we do in life. So when you go back and you start to look at history, ancient history, and you find out that actually, in some cases, they have only one historian that has anything to tell you about it. And the only way you can track whether or not they told you the truth is to try and look at inscriptions on ruins and things of that nature. The conclusions you come to many times are tentative at best. So, this is the general area, and this is the area that we would consider. We've got the green area, which is our Fertile Crescent area. But you see on there the places that are of interest. We've got, what have we got here? We have got Media here. We've got Persia here. The Elamites, this whole area of the Fertile Crescent. We've got the Assyrians here. We've got the Egyptians over here. And these are things that you know, but just to sort of cement them in your mind here as we go forward. All right, so first let's consider the Assyrians. Now, the Assyrian Empire was a long-lasting empire. People talk about the Roman Empire and how it lasted for 1,000 years. Well, the Assyrian Empire lasted for nearly 2,000 years. It was ruled by people that were very, very cruel. They were the terrorists of their time. They intimidated people by their terror, and it worked for them. For the purpose of understanding the rise of the Medes and the Persians, we'll take a look at the kings on the throne of Assyria just for the last 120 years of the empire's existence. We'll forget the first part because it really doesn't concern us. So we'll start with Tiglath-Pileser III. He's the first Assyrian king that we're going to consider, and during his reign, the northern Galilee region of Israel is lost. And this is the beginning of the death throes for the northern kingdom of Israel. So we see here his reign from 745 to 727 BC. He conquers Philistia. The northern area of Israel is strafed during the reigns of Pekah and Hoshea, the last king of the northern kingdom. And Damascus falls under his leadership. Then we come to Shalmaneser V. As we see here, during his reign, he suppressed revolts of Phoenician cities. And King Hoshea and all of Israel fell to him. And that began the end of the northern kingdom, as we have it recorded in Scripture. Next comes Sargon II. Under him, Merodach-Baladan makes himself master of Babylon. Now, at this time in history, Babylon was more or less a client state of Assyria. The people in Babylon were given a governor by the Assyrians. But those governors sometimes decided they wanted to be on their own and would revolt. In fact, that's always a problem with any of the kingdoms in the past. It's one thing to go out and conquer areas It's another thing to keep them under control. Not so easily done. And even if you stamp out a revolt 1 year, 3 or 4 years down the road, there could be another one. And this is the kind of thing that happened, especially toward the end of the Assyrian Empire. So Merodach-Baladan makes himself master of Babylon and begins a struggle to free the people from Assyria. There's also a revolt by Gaza with Egyptian help. That's extinguished by Sargon. There's a revolt by Israel that's put down. And according to the historians here, this is the way they look at it, the actual movement of people out of the northern kingdom happened under some under Shalmaneser, but much of it under Sargon II, because the revolt. They didn't want any more revolts, so to get rid of the revolt is to get rid of the people that are causing revolts. And finally, Judah ends up paying tribute at this time, and they remain in their land, somewhat on their own, but still under the thumb of the Assyrians. Then we come to Sennacherib. He puts down all the uprisings that are coming in Egypt, in Syria, in Palestine, and the Phoenician coast. So you can see there's any. In fact, this is another thing. We kind of see it today in the Middle East. If somebody revolts and there looks like there's some sort of success, then why not me? You know, why not? Why don't we revolt too? Because too revolting, especially if it's against the same main authority, then you might have some success. In this particular case, though, Sennacherib was pretty good at putting down revolts. He retained his sway over Babylon. He added a fleet in the Persian Gulf, which aided him in his war with Elam, which is on the Persian Gulf. And he began a renovation and beautification of Nineveh. He is also the Sennacherib that we find in the scripture, in Isaiah and in the Kings and Chronicles, that deals with the attack in the days of Hezekiah. It was his army that was poised to attack Jerusalem and then was slain. The army was slain all by God's miraculous help. And then, as predicted in the scriptures, he went home, went to bow down to his gods, only to be murdered at that time by his two oldest sons. And so he dies, and the kingdom passes on to another son, Esarhaddon. At this point, Assyria is at the height of her power, This, of course, was somebody's idea, that they were at the height of their power. This is what they concluded. Perhaps they were in some ways. But, you know, to have gone 1,700 years or so to this point, 1,900 years, they're at a point where their power has been manifest for a very long time, been very successful. Maybe they had more capabilities now than they'd ever had before. But at any rate, the thinking was that they were at the height of their power. They had taken a conciliatory policy toward Babylon, which was a policy that had begun under Sargon II, which is to sort of just give them a little leeway, not be very strict with them. He was responsible for some repopulation in Samaria, which we see in evidence in Ezra 4:2, where the inhabitants there make reference to Esarhaddon the Assyrian. He stopped revolts of peoples in the Levant, and he invaded Egypt and captured Memphis. So we get some idea of the power of Esarhaddon. His rule passes on to Ashurbanipal, the last of the kings of Assyria. The thinking was here was that Assyria was at the height of her culture. And I think this is always a good thing to consider, because any empire or great country or nation that comes to the height of their culture is pretty much on their way down, because they come to a point where going to war and keeping the things that they have don't interest them so much. They're too much interested in the other cultural things they have, their art, their poetry, whatever it may be. And that certainly was the case here in Assyria. During his reign, they lost Egypt in a revolt. And during his reign, however, he did strengthen his hold on Asia Minor, the Levant, Babylon, and Elam. He began and actually continued on with his father's beautification business of working on Nineveh and other places. He erected palaces and founded the library at Nineveh, which is something that they found and has been very helpful in determining what kinds of things happened in the past. So now we've come to the end of what happens to Assyria. So now we want to look at the rise of the Medes, because they are associated with the fall of Assyria. And it's something that we don't get too much information on in Scripture. So again, the Medes are in this area here. And we have the main players here are the people, the Median people. Now, their capital is this place up here, Ecbatana. Ecbatana, and Babylon is also plays into the fall of Assyria. And, of course, Assyria is here actually all through this upper area. There are only four kings of Media. So we'll look at the first. The first Median prince is Diosces. He's the one who founded the capital at Ecbatana. No one really knows where Ecbatana is. They think it's in a tell that's near the city of Hamadan. Its name means a meeting place of many ways. It's situated in a high plateau area that's 6,000 feet above sea level. So it's sort of your Denver of the Middle East. Herodotus claims that he was a man of integrity and just, and as such, he sat at the request of his peers to judge disputes of his people until he had decided he had had enough and wished to step down. And the reason they asked him to do this, again, supposedly, is because they were tribal in nature. They had a lot of tribal groups in that area, but they also had a lot of crime, a lot of thievery, a lot of that sort of thing going on, and they were trying to find a way to stop that. And, of course, in some way to do it, one way to do it is to come up with some sort of central authority to do this. Well, in this particular case, he just did it in his tribal area to begin with. He decided finally to step down. But when he decided that, there was a resulting increase in robbery and contempt for law among the tribes of the loosely knit Median society. The leaders looked for remedy and again focused their attention on Diosces. He was willing to be elevated to a position as king, provided they built a royal city, which was Ecbatana, and allowed him a security guard of his own choosing. The ceremonial means of accessing a monarch, like we see in the book of Esther, appears to have Actually, I think we see it in other places, but in terms of, like, for instance, people coming in to see David in some of the scriptures we read, we see that you don't just come in to see King David. You have to be announced, that sort of thing, and he has to agree to see them, much like a president in this country. But in the Middle East, or that is in the Median and Persian society, it's felt that he was the one that started this kind of thing in his area. There was a certain decorum that was to be observed. No laughing or spitting. Those wishing to bring a matter to the king had to announce themselves through a messenger of the king. And casual admittance was strictly forbidden. And this way he protected himself from his peers as good as himself, who might grow to resent or oppose him. When you think about this, it's one thing to be a king over people, having been recognized as such. It's another thing to start a monarchy where you were the same as the guy next door and now you're the king. Do they think you're the king just because you've been made the king? That was part of the thing that he wanted to make sure there was no problem with that. So he more or less insulated himself by these various means. Judicial matters required documents to be presented. In this way, the king might be set apart and those gaining audience might be influenced by both his insularity and magnificent trappings to conclude the monarch to be above the cut of a commoner and convey that conclusion to others. He gave the Medes, therefore, a national integrity, though they appear to have been a vassal state at that time under the Assyrians. So we come to, we come to his son, Phraortes. He is the first leader to unite the whole country of the Medes and to secure its independence, if only temporarily. He first conquered the Persians to the south and made them tributary. He then set his sights on Assyria. Now, Assyria was under its last king, Ashurbanipal. In culture, as we mentioned before, Assyria was at its zenith, but militarily it was enduring all of these revolts from Egypt and Babylon and others. It was putting down rebellions, but it did not have the resources. In fact, that was one of the things about the Assyrian Empire, is that as far as resources go, it didn't really have all that many. It had things flow in to Nineveh and its other major cities from the places that it conquered. So if they lost the places they conquered, then they started to lose the resources that they needed. And because of these revolts, it was the alliances that it once had in several nations were now a problem. Because a lot of these nations were trying to throw off the yoke of the Assyrian. On the particular occasion that Phraortes decided to jump into the battle with the Assyrians, he was killed in the battle. And so the kingdom passed then on to his son, Cyaxares. Now, before we get to Cyaxares, I just threw this in here. This is kind of thing you run into to get you off track when you're trying to do things that you should be doing. This is from a website that purports to know the pedigree of Phraortes, the Median king. And one of the things that it tells us here is that, if I don't know if you can see this on the slide up here, but up here, it claims that Phraortes is the great times 73 grandfather of His Majesty George I, of England. And then here he claims to be the great times 67 grandfather of the Holy Roman Emperor Ferdinand the First. And then here he is the great times 77 grandfather of Osawatomie Brown. Does anybody know who Osawatomie Brown is? Pardon?
Was he the first landscape architect in Britain?
No, he was not. He's, as a matter of fact, he's an American. Osawatomie Brown. Osawatomie is a town in Kansas that was renowned for its problems with those who were slavers, because Kansas wanted to be an anti-slavery state, a free state. So Osawatomie Brown is a Mr. Brown who was involved in this conflict with the slavers, otherwise known as John Brown, of fame for you people out in Virginia, where he tried to take over an armory. So, I don't know whether this is true, but interesting. Okay. So the kingdom passes on to Kyaxares. So Kyaxares sought to avenge his father's death with Assyria. He had a successful battle with them. And isn't this the way things go? He had a successful battle with the Assyrians, but on his way back to Media, he met an army of Scythians in pursuit of Sumerians, coming from the Caucasus as he was laying siege to the city. And he was forced to retreat and submit to the Scythians for the next 28 years, as did most of the people in that area. That period was marked by chaos and lawlessness as the Scythians arbitrarily requested tribute and forcibly exacted it. According to Herodotus, Kyaxares devised a plot whereby the greater number of the Scythian leaders were invited to a banquet where they were made drunk and murdered. And so, Kyaxares again gained control of his kingdom. In 612 BC, Kyaxares creates an alliance with Nabopolassar, the Assyrian governor of Babylon, who made himself independent during the weakness that was suffered by the Assyrians under the Scythian domination. So Kyaxares sealed this alliance by giving his daughter Amytis in marriage to Nabopolassar's son Nebuchadnezzar. This is the wife of Nebuchadnezzar for whom he created the Hanging Gardens in an effort to assuage her homesickness for the cooler climate of Ecbatana. Kyaxares captured Nineveh and destroyed the Assyrian Empire. And on the wind of this success, he swept into Asia Minor and conquered until he came to Lydia. And Lydia's capital was Sardis. That victory was snatched from his hands by an eclipse of the sun. This heavenly portent caused all of the armies to cease and to return to their tents. The kingdom then passes on to Astyages. Astyages was a tyrant. And here I'm going to give you mostly what Herodotus claims on this. It's, again, you can find different information if you want to take a look at Xenophon or some of the others. But I'm going to go with this simply because I like the story the best. All right, so Astyages, it is claimed, had a dream in which his daughter made water in quantities enough to flood all of Asia. So he sought the Magi for an interpretation. And as a result, he determined not to marry his daughter to any noble Mede, lest there be a threat to his empire, but to some Persian in good standing, and thus get her out of the kingdom. His daughter, Mandanine, was given in marriage to a Persian named Cambyses. And she was not married a year before Astyages had another dream. And this time, the Magi gave Astyages to fear for his kingdom through the child his daughter would bear. So Astyages sent for his daughter and brought her back so that he might make sure the child died after birth. When the child was born, Astyages gave it to Harpagus, a relative and steward of his property, to slay. Harpagus was then to bury the child as he pleased. Well, Harpagus had reservations about the king's command. After all, Mandani was in line of succession. What if something happened to Astyages and she gained the throne? Would he not be found an offender as the murderer of her firstborn child? So Harpagus decided to have a herdsman of Astyages kill the child. The herdsman is summoned and given the child, and the herdsman is commanded to kill the child and bring Harpagus proof of the deed. And the herdsman is also not happy with the assignment, but he takes the child and he brings the child to his home and the fellow slave woman with whom he lives. The herdsman tells the woman who the young child is and what it is that he's supposed to do. And the woman suggests an alternative course of action. She was also pregnant and gave birth that very day to a stillborn child. She suggests they keep the live child and send the stillborn child to Harpagus as proof the son of Mandani is indeed dead, and thus procure for it a royal burial. The herdsman and his woman raise the child, who would become known as Cyrus. They do that till the age of 10. Then, as it happens, in a child's game, a game of king, he is chosen to be king. And Cyrus gives command to the other children, and all of them obey but one. Cyrus commands the other children to arrest this child. And when Cyrus beats him with a whip, the beaten child goes home and complains to his influential father, who in turn brings the matter to Astyages. When the herdsman child is brought before Astyages, Astyages angrily confronts the slave's son who so badly treated a nobleman's son. From his calm demeanor and aristocratic air in replying to Astyages, Astyages guesses that he is not the herdsman's son. The herdsman is summoned and threatened with torture if he does not reveal the truth. So the herdsman tells the story to Astyages. And Astyages then visits Harpagus, who had seen that the herdsman was in the palace, and thus he revealed his actions in the matter in a straightforward way, didn't try to lie about anything. So Astyages reveals to Harpagus that the child did not die, and as I say, Harpagus comes forth straightforward. Now, the fact that he didn't die, Astyages says, in a way of concealing his own displeasure with Harpagus, he says, well, this is a good thing. It's a good thing that he didn't actually die back when I commanded you to kill him. It's all good fortune. And so what he has done is and he says one of the reasons that it's a good thing is because he is, of course, had he done it, he would have given great, well, of course, as far as his daughter is concerned, he did do it. Because for these 10 years, he's thought he's dead, and so does his daughter. And so his thing is that this is now good fortune because he's given his daughter very good grounds to hate him, but now this can be remedied because he's actually alive. Well, Harpagus has a son, and he's sent to get to know Cyprus. And then Harpagus is invited to the king's feast. And when Harpagus' son arrives, he's taken by the guards, he's butchered, some parts roasted, the rest boiled, and the meal is served, and Harpagus dines on his son. At the end of the meal, Harpagus is presented with the heads and hands and feet of his son and realizes what Astyages has done. And when he's asked by Astyages if he knows what has occurred, he says, "I know, and may the king's will be done." And Astyages, again, consults the Magi concerning this new development. This son is now, his grandson is alive, so what is he to do? Well, the Magi say that the prophecy regarding his kingship was fulfilled when he became king in the game that the children played. He was king once, he will not be king again. However, as a precaution, they suggest he be sent out of the country to his birth parents. And so Cyrus joins his parents at Cambyses' palace in Persia. And from this point on, Harpagus, who is, of course, who said, "May the king's will be done," is not very happy. And so he seeks opportunity to help Cyrus defeat the grandfather who sought his death. And Cyrus grows to become a great leader in Persia. And eventually, Harpagus is able to secretly send word to Cyrus to lead a Persian revolt, which will coincide with the king's ministers agreeing to dethrone Astyages. And in this manner, Astyages was summarily dethroned. And the Median Empire ended, being swallowed up by the Persian under the leadership of Cyrus the Persian Mede. That is a story you can chew on. We've come to 11 o'clock, and we'll stop there, and we'll pick this up tomorrow.